From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia is away this week. On today's show, everyone has an opinion, but who's the decider when it comes to a new airport?
The simple answer is Kansas City. Kansas City's in charge.
We visit a Mexican-American fast-pitch softball league with deep roots in Kansas.
You know, it's a big deal. Basically, kind of like our little World Series.
And a special documentary on how a Kansas town disappeared.
So this is home, huh?
This was home at one time.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Kansas City International Airport is looking at a potentially major change, tearing down the current three terminals and moving to a single new terminal on the site of the current Terminal A. The one terminal idea came to a head in 2008 when the master plan called for a new central terminal south of the current airport. That came just 4 years after the airport wrapped up nearly $260 million in renovations. KCUR's Maria Carter brings us this look at how we got where we are and who makes the decision.
In April, the Kansas City, Missouri City Council approved an update to the master plan, unveiling a terminal building on the site of what's now Terminal A at the airport. That's when the public outcry started. Many Kansas Cityans love KCI's layout. They point to how easy it is to get in and out of the airport. Kansas City Mayor Sly James quickly named an advisory group about the airport. James said the panel had to answer two questions.
Is KCI, as it is currently configured, the best airport for residents and visitors of this city? Second, if it is not, what are the options for an airport that will serve this region for future generations?
The city's plan for the airport's on hold until the advisory group wraps up its work. However, that's far from the only group looking over the proposal. The FAA, for one, is making its own assessment, looking at how much it will cost, how it will be paid for, and how it will affect the environment. FAA approval is needed because, technically, every commercial airport in the country belongs to the federal government. Kansas City Aviation Director Mark Van Loe says the FAA has to sign off on any construction.
Everything we do on an airport has to be approved by the FAA. If I want to build a hangar or somebody needs to build a new road, it has to be approved by the FAA. They pay for a majority of what we do on an airport, so obviously the person with the most money wins, and in this case it's the government.
The FAA needs to put its rubber stamp on the city's tentative plan, but a slew of other agencies, such as the Homeland Security Administration and the Environmental Protection Agency, also get a say. But no agency can demand the city build a single terminal. In fact, Van Loe says it's ultimately up to the city.
The simple answer is Kansas City. Kansas City's in charge.
The group Friends of KCI wants to make sure the decision isn't left to the politicians in City Hall, but to voters. The group's leader, John Murphy, says citizens need more of a say in the process.
It's extremely important. It's our money. It's our government. They work for us, not the other way around. It just seems lately that local officials just seem to look at us as an open blank checkbook.
Friends of KCI is gathering signatures on an initiative petition that would change city code to require a public vote on any demolition or construction of an airport terminal. Even if the initiative petition doesn't make it to the ballot, Kansas City voters may have the final say on the $1.2 billion terminal in the form of a bond vote. Aviation bonds, though they'd be paid for by various fees at the airport, still require approval from the voters. Maria Carter, KCUR News.
Coming up, how Treece, Kansas became a ghost town. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith.
Latrice, Kansas was incorporated in 1918 as a home for lead and zinc miners. After World War II, the industry began to drag. The area's last mines closed in the 1970s, leaving behind a small community of the children and grandchildren of miners. Treece is part of Tar Creek, the largest EPA Superfund site in the United States. Poor mining practices left the ground unstable and susceptible to sinkholes, and mountains of chat, the toxic remnants of the mining, surround the town. According to a 2009 EPA test, 8.8% of the children in Treece were shown to have elevated blood lead levels compared to just 2.9% statewide. The residents of Treece asked the government for help. In 2009, Congress passed a bill authorizing the funding for a voluntary buyout.
The Recollective, a group of independent audio producers, went to Treece in 2009 to talk with people about their thoughts on the buyout. They returned again in 2012 when nearly all the residents had left Treece and the streets were turning into grasslands. In the next half hour, we're going to hear what they heard from the former residents of Treece.
It's approximately 12 miles from here, where Treece is located, what used to be Treece.
Bill Blanc is the last mayor of Treece, Kansas. We're barreling down Highway 69 towards Treece. Bill and I in his truck, his wife Judy and my co-producer Chayla following in the car behind.
You know, as of January of 2013, it will no longer be on the maps.
I first met Bill in 2009. I called him after reading an article about his town. The article painted a pretty bleak picture of the place. Uncapped mine shafts, piles of contaminated mining waste, the scars of a near century worth of lead and zinc mining. But it was one line at the end of the story that captured my attention. Quote, Blanc, who makes $1 a year as mayor, mows the lawn at City Hall. The citizens of Treece were in the middle of lobbying for the Environmental Protection Agency to buy their homes so that the 100 or so residents could get out. And it puzzled me that in a town so polluted that even the townspeople wanted to walk away, Bill mowed the lawn. Still, he cared. And walking away might not be as easy as the article was making it out to be.
I didn't want the buyout. You know, I didn't. Treece is home to me, you know. It was my old stomping ground.
He invited me over the phone to see that lawn. It's hard to say no to Bill. His wife Judy will tell you as much. He convinced her to marry him after just 2 weeks.
I don't know. There was just something about him. His brown eyes, his cute little smile, that he kind of smirky smile. And
I had hair.
Yeah, he had a lot of hair. And it was just, we met on the Greyhound bus on the, you know, he's in the very back, and I was one seat up. We raised two beautiful boys since then.
Shortly after my visit, the town got what it asked for, $3.5 million allocated by the federal government for resettlement. By July 2012, when Chayla and I took this ride with Bill and Judy back to Treece, the town was gone. No buildings left.
So this is home, huh?
This was home at one time.
This is the story about the making of a ghost town.
The Ozarks lie in the belly of America. Midway between the oceans, 600 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico. From the Ozarks come the greater number of the mine workers who live now in a strange country.
This is part of the area of Kansas that they called the Little Balkans because of all the mining at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. My name is Doug Gatewood. I'm from Columbus, Kansas. I'm the first district Kansas state representative.
At the turn of the 20th century, Doug's district was one of the largest producers of lead and zinc in the world. Mining was so important to this area that to this day, people still stake claim to having mined the lead for the bullets that won the two world wars. This lead was also being used for paint, batteries, gasoline, and toys.
We had coal mining in the north part of my district. We had lead and zinc mining in the southeastern portion of the district. So we had mining wherever you went.
Treece, Kansas sits at the center of the largest, most productive lead mine field in the area, the Pitcher Field. While most of the mining died off in the 1950s, the Pitcher Field continued to be mined into the 70s.
Kansas, you typically think of as being flat plains. However, my part of the district is the only part of Kansas that has small hills. And, of course, a lot of the hills that you see aren't natural. They're the result of the mining. The King Jack Mine had the largest hill, and it was 440 feet.
Except these hills aren't hills at all. They're mounds of what is called chat.
Chat piles are tailing piles. Tailing piles are crushed rock. This rock is waste rock, rock from which the ore has been extracted.
I've always heard stories of the Eagle Pitcher chat pile was so big it went into the clouds. When the low clouds and stuff would come in, it would cover the top of it. My name is Jeremy Johnston. I was born in Columbus, Kansas, but lived here in Treece pretty much my entire life. A chat rat meant you were from Treece or Pitcher or Carden or Hawkerville or Commerce. If somebody called you a chat rat, people knew where you were from. Down here on the corner, just to the south, there's part of a chat pile that still stands down there. That was actually called the Captain. There was one across the mile section. We called it the Red Chat Pile, but everybody from like other places called it Yellow Mountain. I don't know why. Then there was the Peak or the Finger, because it was part of a chat pile that had hardened over time. And when they dug it out, there was a part of it that stuck out, looked like a finger pointing into the sky. I knew the chat piles like the back of my hand. It was just part of living here.
People would park on both sides of roads just to watch these bikes go up and down this chat pile, trying to see who could make it up the top.
Mayor Bill Blunk.
We'd take car windshields or car hoods and then just get on it and sail away. There's no stopping, no brakes, nothing. You just slide down this chat pile like umpteen miles an hour. I mean, it's awesome. And to do it on the snow was even better because, I mean, as a kid, you might have only been doing 30 or 40, you know. But on the ice, you would think you're doing 60 or 70. You'd slide almost 2 miles before you come to a stop.
Do you even recognize anything?
No.
I mean, it's heartbreaking.
Bill's wife, Judy, walks ahead, pointing from side to side.
Jim and Teresa Palmer lived right there. And then Bud and Brenda Shaw lived right beside them in a little house that was ran down really bad. And then, let's see, you're getting ready to come up to Pitcher and Park. Jan Leatherman lived right on the corner.
I decided to build a yard that would be my paradise. My name is Janice Leatherman, and I lived in Treece 42 years.
She had a flower garden. She loved flowers.
She had flowers galore, and she moved out last year.
The kids and just friends, they brought the cedar trees. We planted them all along the north side, and mercy, every month I planted it so that every month the yard would be filled with something. And there were roses, and Pam helped me.
Pink ladies.
Irises everywhere, daffodils, and the little narcissa plant flowers, beautiful hybrid irises and Japanese irises, and just suddenly it's just your little paradise. Treece was so quiet, I would get desperately lonely sometimes. People would look at you in Baxter, Columbus, like they felt sorry for you. You felt ashamed. I hate to say that. You felt ashamed to say you were from there, and I didn't want to say that. I didn't want to feel that way, I mean.
I'm going down this road feeling bad. I'm going down this road feeling bad, bad, bad. And I ain't going to be
Lead ore going to the smelter works at Joplin. Lead ore going to the smelter in Galena. Smelter in Galena is the biggest in the district. The biggest in the district. The biggest in the district. Tons of zinc ore coming out hourly. Tons of tailings building up mountains. Clouds of dust to cover up the little town. Cave-ins over at Baxter Springs. Danger of lead poison. Danger from dust. Men drop down the shaft, down the shaft, down the shaft. Lead for pipes and bullets and gases. Zinc for medicines and batteries and paint. Thousands of tons of rock ore daily. It's $1 million business. $1 million business. $1 million, $1 million, 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 million.
The winds would blow. The chat would fly. It was just everywhere. My name is Pam Pritt. I lived at 245 Washington Street in Therese, Kansas. I was a city water clerk for a lot of years. So I'm going to sound like an idiot. I never realized what those chat piles were, really, until I got to digging into it. They're just full of lead. And I'm probably not educated, maybe not smart, I don't know. But I guess in my mind, I thought, well, if it was that bad, they wouldn't be here.
The area was declared a Superfund site by the Environmental Protection Agency in 1983. Superfund sites are large areas contaminated with hazardous waste material. The land around Therese has been ranked one of the most environmentally devastated places in the country. Most of the mining companies responsible for the mess are long gone, out of business, or have managed to pay only a tiny fraction of the cleanup costs, leaving the federal government to step in. Since the area was declared a Superfund site, the EPA has been working to clean up the contamination, but there's too much and it is too toxic. High concentrations of lead, zinc, and cadmium from mine waste were found in the groundwater and creeks near Therese. Traces of lead were found in yards, in playgrounds, in the chat piles, and in the dust in people's homes. Lead exposure, even in the smallest amounts, can cause all kinds of health issues. It's especially dangerous for kids, who can end up with permanent learning disabilities.
Tar Creek was about two blocks from my house. Part of it, it ran from the north through Therese. And people used to go down there and take their kids and swim in it before anyone knew how bad it was. It was just an old creek, you know, with chat piles all around it. And so we did, but my kids got ear infections immediately. So I would never let them go again, ever.
It wasn't until 2009 that Therese residents were tested for lead, and the results weren't surprising. Lead levels among young children were 3 times higher than the national average.
The EPA came in and tested not just the children, but the adults, too. They have a criteria there where it's over 10, it becomes really bad and poisoning. I remember asking them, well, how much is too much? One of the nurses said to me, no level of lead in the blood is acceptable. So my children grew up with their lead never being tested.
We called experts and talked to doctors and scientists who studied the area, and they all agree on one point. The landscape is toxic. Still, they all say, there haven't been enough studies to prove exactly what the consequences of the mining has been on people's health. And since people have left the area, it's probably too late to ever know. Even people who grew up there wonder how the pollution might have affected them. Heart conditions, lung cancer, kidney disease, autoimmune disorders, learning disabilities, the list goes on.
There's the people that realize what lead does, and they're ready to go. And then there's the ones that are like, we've lived here our whole life, we're still breathing, this is stupid.
I've lived here my entire life, and I'm fine.
Again, Therese resident Jerry Johnston.
I don't have any defects that I know of, but I'm only 39 years old. I'm not, you know, it may change when I'm 50, 60. There may be something that comes up because I've lived here. You know, I'll worry about it if it ever happens. This is home. This is all I've ever known is home, and I'm perfectly content being here. If I wasn't, I wouldn't be here now.
Wow, this feels really soft.
Pretty mushy, isn't it? But look at that, your shoes aren't wet.
No, but you can feel how soft.
Feels like you're walking through mud, but your feet aren't getting wet. So that's...
Right. Next stop, 12 feet down, huh?
Yeah.
Whew, at least, right?
You're pretty brave to, like, stand on the edge.
Oh, I can swim.
State Representative Doug Gatewood. His side job is mowing this enormous field full of sinkholes.
The more catastrophic cave-ins that we have seen happen as far back as the 1960s, the mining companies would come in. They just kept going, and in one instance, there's only 34 feet of overburden. That's the ceiling that's left. And the actual hole is approximately 200 feet. When you get down to the Trace, Pitcher, Commerce area, that's where the deeper mines were, and that's where the really catastrophic cave-ins are going to happen. They're not 12 feet. They're 200, 220 feet. And 12 feet, you'll survive. You might have a tough time getting out, but you won't the bigger drops. And it's big enough that, in the case of Trace, it could literally swallow the whole city.
I mean, 200 feet is, like, just to put that into perspective, I mean, it's...
Well, it'd be a 20-story building.
Right. It's crazy.
And that's, like, all what's underneath Highway 69.
Yep. 69 Highway that runs just south of the town is where the largest mine was. And rumor has it you could fit the Astrodome in the hole. And you're driving over that hole when you go on 69 Highway.
So do you drive over that highway?
I do. Yeah, if it's my time, it's my time.
This area here is another one. Afraid to walk over that?
Yeah.
You can pretty much tell if you're from the area. You know, if you see pastures all across here and you see one section like that the grass is tall, it's unkept, nobody goes there. There's a reason they don't.
It's too... You don't want cattle falling in, huh?
Yeah, or people.
Or people.
I didn't like living life on the edge. Wake up one day and be in a hole in the ground. I didn't want that. Doug Gatewood, he was our ear.
Gets more dangerous every day. It's not a question of if we're going to have a cave-in. It's a question of when. So we know that it's contaminated. We know that there's a hole underneath it. We know that the city's losing services. So what more do we have to do to justify that this needs done? I asked for a town meeting, and I passed around a notebook, said write your name, your address, and then put a little note whether you're for or against a buyout. Out of the 79 people that were attending the meeting, 76 of them said that they supported the buyout. Some real reluctance, but they supported the concept.
The kids were grown up, and I just continued to live there because we couldn't get out. Unless you had a lot of money of your own, you know, just to leave your house and move. You couldn't borrow money because it was condemned land. And if the person had cash to pay for your house, that was okay, but most people didn't. And we needed enough to get another house to live in. And once they heard it was from Therese, well, they thought they could get it for $500 or a couple of $1,000, you know. But that's not possible.
The town rallied together to plead their case, but it wasn't as easy as it sounded. It took Tree several years to get the attention of the state and federal government. Finally, a buyout came through. $3.5 million was allocated to the town, and a trust, a group of people appointed by the Kansas governor, was set up to manage it. First step, appraising people's property value.
We all think that our property is worth a lot more than it's appraised for by an outsider. And if the appraiser comes from a very good, nice, beautiful home and looked at the houses and trees, even mine, why, they wonder how you can live there, you know. But I thought my house wasn't that bad. It's the one in the picture there on the wall. But one was really high, really high. One was really low, and one was in the middle. So they averaged them out. And then they gave us 20% more.
The average appraisal for a home in Trace was less than $20,000. The residents took the money they got and tried to find a new home in a new town, leaving behind their empty houses. Once everyone was gone, the trust hired auctioneer Colonel Jerry Chestnut
me,
to sell off the empty houses.
You had people that were buying, you know, to move them on their lots, or you had people buying them for salvage.
It was a nice day. It seemed like it was a real warm day. And people would get there early. They could go around and go into the homes and check them out. And then they'd auction them from the steps of City Hall.
I sell it to you right there. Get $180, $190, $180, $190, $210, $210, $210, $210, $220, $220, $230.
We lived on Washington Street there in Treese, and I had a double wide. The house had been empty for probably a couple months before they auctioned it. It was a weird feeling because the first thing you're thinking, if nobody buys that thing, that's going to be embarrassing. Yeah. It's like, oh, this is great.
Of course, some of the houses were so bad that basically, you know, some of them bring a dollar a piece, and the people that bought them might have wanted a doorknob off of them or something, and they just left the rest.
I could not stand the thought of somebody walking through my home looking at it. I felt like I was just wide open for everybody to come in and look and judge my home. I'm not so private, but yet my home, I don't know how to explain. It killed me to finally turn over the key for that reason. But anyway, I did. But that was a hard thing for me that day, to wonder what people thought of my home. I guess it's pride. I don't know. But, you know.
I think the sales took about an hour apiece, something like that. It don't take very long. Either somebody gets in or you back up to 500. Just say, sold number 82. Because, you know, they'd be holding up a number. $300, $500, $300, $500, $600, $700, $800, $900, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000, $1,000,
We are this nation. This is our country. The richest country in the world. A fertile earth and forests. Power and great industry. We live here.
The city of Treece, Kansas, established in the year 1918, was dissolved in April of 2012.
As I drive through Treece, it's just like you're driving into a Twilight Zone episode. You look, and at one point, the people were gone, the houses were still there. Then you drive through later, and the houses are gone. The streets are still there. And now I drive through and the streets are gone. It's just devolution. It is a surreal feeling.
See, we moved in January. I continued going back to the city to do my jobs until it closed in August. So every month that I went back, more and more were moving. I remember that day I sat out there and I thought that people move all the time and it's not hard. Why is this so hard? And I realized because of being able to tangibly look and put your hand on something and say, my mother-in-law lived there. And, you know, we'd walk down that street. And then I thought, just like this town's going to be gone one day. One day I'm going to be gone. You know, it's just, I had a place where we measured the kids as they grew. It was on the wall in the hallway when they were little, just marking them, all three kids as they grew. And I wished I had cut that out, but I didn't. Yeah, so I didn't. I was never so glad as when that day came that I didn't have to go back anymore. And then I didn't have to deal with it, those emotions.
You will not see it. You won't even know where it was. And this town has had, other than trees and weeds and grass and a few flowers, there's nothing there to say who lived where or I think this was here or maybe it was God meant. Who knows what might happen underground yet?
For 3/8 of a mile either way on the road and 3/8 of a mile deep, you know, it's ours. Nobody can take that away from us.
Most everyone left town, but Jerry Johnston didn't take the buyout. He has stayed in his house on the outskirts of Treece. He lives with his girlfriend and daughter next door to his parents, who also decided to stay.
I can basically hunt and fish and do whatever I want any direction from my front door. Even if I become filthy, stinking rich, I'm going to stay right here.
When I first campaigned, I would walk door to door. First time I walked through Trace, I went home and cried my eyes out. Just the thoughts, seeing the kids out playing, you know, they didn't have the ability to escape their environment. They deserve better than that. I don't feel good about it. I just feel like we did what was necessary and what was right, not what was good. But every now and again, something pops up to where you have to wonder, you know, why didn't somebody watch this?
Every street here is named after a mama. Every street. You have Prospect. Then you have Kansas. Then you have Park.
It's been over a year since Bill and Judy moved out of Trees.
And on the corner, my property was there. It started there and ended on Kansas, which is a block west of us.
They chose to move their double-wide trailer home from that plot in Trees to a new tract of land 12 miles away. But the imprint of their driveway in Trees is still there, leading to a patch of dirt where the house once stood.
I guess you could say I owned the city block, and it was immaculate. There wasn't even a bubble gum wrapper in my yard over here. I mean, from this street to the last street down there, it was perfect. I mean, a beautiful one. I don't want to really boast about my property that I had here, but it was the prettiest lawn in Trees. I kept it. I made sure it was that way. I wanted to keep it up with the Joneses in a small town. I guess you could say that, you know.
Not happy. It's just too much of a change for me. Bill's trying everything he can to make it happy. And I respect him for that. I do. We have a garden now, but it's just not the same.
His lawn, that lawn, has turned into a mess of weeds and wildflowers. The new garden's big, the lawn twice as large, and all open. No trees. The trees they left behind.
I left one great big elm tree that I planted as a little root. And now I couldn't move it. And he was going to leave 20 roses of Sharon's. And I said, oh, no, but you're not. If I have to get out there with the shovel, they're all coming with me. So now I've got 19 out of 20. So.
Yeah, you could probably still see the outline of the garden. The grass would probably be greener back there. If I had my shovel, I could show you. I'd dig one shovel full down, and it would be black. That's my catalpa tree. She was my baby. She's about 100 years old, maybe 150. She would not shed a leaf, wouldn't start blooming until the last frost. And that's when I knew to plant the garden, when she started blooming.
I'd move back there in a heartbeat because that's where I want to be, okay?
But why would you want to move back knowing that could possibly, not scientifically proven, that it's causing your health problems? Why would you want to move back?
Because you're going to die one way or the other. You're going to go see Jesus sooner or later. You ain't going to be able to do anything about it.
Why rush it?
Why rush it?
What if it's not your time to go and you go back there and look what I have planned for you, Miss Judy?
Well, as long as you don't take your own life, you know, you're still going to see Jesus.
Wouldn't that be kind of committing suicide knowing that...
No, not in my book. It's not the way I was raised.
That it's contaminated, it's not fit for human.
No, because my question is now, they're going to auction off all that land as pasture land, okay? And when they do that, they're going to let you graze cattle, whatever, but you can't live on it. Now, wait a minute, I have a problem with that. It's not good enough for us to live on it, but it's grazing land for an animal. And when you're going to slaughter that cow or pig, you're going to eat it. and that's going to go right into your system. Now, that don't make no sense to me.
This is the tree that I planted. It's an elm tree from a stick. And look how tall it is.
Oh, my God. It must be like 30, 40 feet high.
It's up there. That was just from a stick with a couple of strings hanging down from it.
Judy starts to walk through a patch of tall grass to the base of her old elm tree.
If I had my way about it, I'd take a start off my elm tree I planted, and I'd take it right over there, and I'd plant it anyway, whether he wanted it or not. Yeah, well,
maybe you should go and sneak one right now.
She stares down at the base of the tree.
You never know. You never know what I'll do.
And starts to forage for a sapling to take.
You have to get one of those saplings at the bottom.
Yeah, at the bottom.
Want me to try?
I just don't have the strength. After I've had heart surgery, I don't have the strength in my chest to...
Okay. Which one is it?
It's coming right out of the trunk.
This guy?
Yeah.
Chayla and I followed Bill and Judy back to the edge of town where we had parked, Judy clutching her new elm sapling. We stood around the cars making small talk. No one wanted to be the first to drive away. Finally, Bill got into the truck. Judy followed.
This is just another chapter within our lives, and that chapter was closed and we opened a new. I wouldn't go back. No, that's my past life.
And then they drove away.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This documentary was called Treece, Kansas, Ghost Town in the Making. It was produced by Chayla Herridge-Meyer and Nina Porzuki of The Recollective and made possible by a grant from the Kansas Humanities Council.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Currents today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
Coming up next, summer in Kansas is the season for fast-pitch softball. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Alex Smith. Mexican-American fast-pitch softball has historic roots in Kansas and Missouri. Every summer, Mexican-Americans play a game that's wrapped up in family ties and traditions. There's also a tournament in Newton, Kansas that's the oldest of its kind. KCUR's Zach Lewandowski has the story.
About 20 friends and family members greet each other on the bleachers of a softball field. A local men's fast-pitch softball team begins warming up in the outfield. Everyone from the players to the crowd seems to know each other. First names are replaced with nicknames, and dugouts are never quiet. The team warming up and wearing carnelian red jerseys is the Kansas City Angels. They've been playing since the 1960s. The team is made up of several amateur athletes. Many of the players have college and professional experience, with some even being part of Major League Baseball teams' farm systems. In 2009, the Angels won a national fast-pitch tournament in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. They were the first Latino team to win that tournament as part of the North American Fast-Pitch Association. But for the Angels, one tournament in Newton, Kansas means a little more than the rest.
You know, it's a big deal. Basically, kind of like our little World Series.
That's Angels pitcher Luis Vaca. And every year, he and his teammates take part in the Newton Mexican-American Fast-Pitch Softball Tournament. It is the oldest Mexican-American tournament of its kind in the country, and this year marks the 65th anniversary of the competition traditionally held the weekend after Independence Day. Teams from all over the country venture into Kansas to play fast-pitch softball, and Vaca's team has won the tournament 3 of the last 5 years. He says the tournament has special meaning.
You're playing for pride amongst your peers, you know, your family. Many different guys on these teams are family, so basically playing for bragging rights.
When Vaca says the guys on the team are family, he means that literally. A combination of brothers and cousins make up about 3/4 of the Angels roster, which is pretty typical of Mexican-American softball teams. Most players have parents and grandparents who played before them, and the reason is found several generations ago, when during the early 20th century, Mexican immigrants began entering into assimilation projects in the United States. These projects were designed to get immigrants accustomed to the United States culture and included having immigrants play baseball and softball games, since baseball is considered the national pastime. Combined with expanding railroads into the Midwest, which provided jobs, Mexican Americans began building neighborhoods that gravitated towards softball.
A lot of the Mexican migration to Kansas in the early part of the 20th century was to work on the railroad. And that's how you get these communities in Topeka, Newton, some of the smaller towns.
And the process of how Mexican Americans came to incorporate baseball and softball into their culture is complex. This got the interest of Kansas University Associate Professor Ben Chappell, who's an anthropologist currently researching Mexican-American culture in the area.
So there are Mexican-American communities in these places that were very tight-knit, and one thing that people have told me in the research is that the tradition of softball tournaments gave them a great opportunity to go meet people with similar backgrounds in other parts of the state.
Chappell's research found that these projects assume that Mexican Americans would eventually lose what he calls distinctive ethnic identities. But that didn't happen.
What actually happened was that Fort became a community institution that, you know, people could really invest with their own local identities. You know, they were playing for their neighborhood a lot of times, so it really became their own institution.
Mexican Americans faced racial discrimination and weren't allowed to play in most tournaments, which led them to establish their own tournaments like the one in Newton. Now softball tournaments are social events for the whole community, and community pride inspires some to even invest their own money into the teams. Like Chris Medina. He's a former Angels player turned general manager. He acts as a sponsor, giving the team money to travel to national tournaments. He even helps bring players in from other areas, including Mexico. And some teams actually reach out to different continents.
There's a number of teams here right now that have some pitchers from Australia and New Zealand, and so they'll bring them over. They'll pay their salaries. They'll get them a job, pay their expenses to and from, and they'll live here for the, which is their winter, and they'll live, and they'll live here for the summer, and then they go back to their country.
Angels head coach Manuel Hernandez has 2 sons and several other relatives currently playing for the Angels. He's best friends with Medina and has always had a passion for fast pitch. Written on the side of his hat is the word Rabbit, a nickname from his playing days to which most people know him by today. Rabbit even got the attention of the Kansas City Royals. He tried out for one of their training camps, but a family tradition took precedence.
Made it to the final cut, and then a softball tournament came up, and my father, we went to the softball tournament.
While choosing fast-pitch softball over a chance to play for the Royals might seem crazy to some, for Rabbit, it was about tradition and a sport that has always been a part of him.
I mean, back then when my father played, you know what, they didn't get a lot of opportunities to play baseball. My father and my dad's brothers were fortunate to play it, but a lot of them, after the war, developed this softball league. Ever since that, I would say it's still traditional.
And this tradition survives mostly by word of mouth. Official histories of Mexican-American softball are hard to find, and the best sources on the subject are the players and families themselves, something Ben Chappell discovered during his research.
When I go to a tournament anywhere, whether it's in Houston, San Antonio, Kansas City, Topeka, Newton, every tournament that I've been to, on some level, is like a little museum. People will bring out photographs, they'll bring out old programs, they'll bring out posters from old, from former years, or they'll just sit around and tell stories, you know, about the old days. So this is a history that is very well remembered, but it's not well documented in sort of the official archives.
Which Chappell says can be traced back to the goals of assimilation.
Another piece of the kind of assimilation theory that, you know, if whatever is unique or particular to the experience of people of Mexican descent is going to disappear over time, then why bother documenting it and preserving that? And fortunately, that's an idea that has changed quite a lot.
Fast pitch softball might not lead to big paydays or recognition, but for Mexican Americans who enjoy the game, time spent with family and friends is reason enough to continue tradition. For Casey Currents, I'm Zach Lewandowski.
Local jazz band The Grand Marquis just released a new CD entitled Blues and Trouble. It's their seventh in the 14 years they've been together. Founded in 1998, the band performs Prohibition-era style jazz and blues music. The Grand Marquis have performed all over the country and will soon be heading up the Dayton Blues Festival in Florida. But if you can't make the trip, don't worry. They'll be playing at Jazz, Louisiana Kitchen, on July 18th. We close our show with this track entitled Bed of Nails.
In a feather bed, bigger pillow for to lay my head. I used to sleep like a baby in a feather bed. Now I wake up in the morning feeling like I'm dead, 'cause I'm sleeping on a bed of nails. Sleeping on a bed of nails. I'm sleeping on a bed of nails. I'm sleeping on a bed of nails. Built this bed one nail at a time. Built my bed one nail at a time. Built this bed one nail at a time. I nail for every time I hurt you, every time I lie. Now I'm sleeping on a bed of nails. Sleeping on a bed of nails. I'm sleeping on a bed of nails. I'm sleeping on a bed of
on a bed of nails, sleeping on a bed.
We certainly appreciate you tuning into KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with associate producer Alex Smith. Our interns are Monica Sandretsky and Ryan Schisler. Theme music is by Approach, and I'm Susan Wilson.
I'm Alex Smith. Sylvia will be back next week.